catch some of you up who may be joining us midstream, and then we'll pray and open for this particular segment of our discussion, Christianity and culture. We're talking about here laying the groundwork for a biblical theological view of our relationship to culture in this time between the times. There isn't sort of a mathematical formula that simply says this is the Christian approach to culture in all times and places. There is a time for cult and culture, or religion and everything else, to be completely united in one theocracy. And so you're going to have different answers to the same questions if you're living in Eden than you are if you're living east of Eden, if you're living in Israel, or if you're living in Babylon or Greece or wherever the exile has taken you. And according to the New Testament, our era that marks our existence today is that of sojourners and foreigners in this present evil age. That's who we are. We are sojourners, we are aliens, we are strangers in this time between the times. And in this time between the times, our goal is not to hate our neighbors, run from the world on one hand, or to try to rule and dominate them on the other, but to live side by side with them, to recognize that in this era, God sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. God makes no distinctions based on race, color, or creed. Yes, even creed, even God himself, when it comes to rain and sunshine and food and so forth. Well, no, we're the king's kids. We ought to get the best. No, not necessarily. That's why the psalmist could say, my feet almost slipped when I saw what happened to the rich. They seem to live pretty well. They seem to have no worries. It's a little different from what we, many of us anyway, grew up with. They're so unhappy. You know, that we got to bring them here because they're so unhappy. You got to find another reason because a lot of them are very, very happy. And that's what the psalmist saw. He said, I'm not happy. They're happy. I'm not happy. That's what often happens when you become a Christian. So someone should tell you beforehand so you're not shocked. But this is we're living east of Eden. The same period, the same kind of polity or politics or relationship between the kingdom of God and the kingdoms of this world that obtained between Cain and Seth. That great list of all of the things that Cain's children were doing to create civilization. And then Seth and his children were born, and we read, then men began to call on the name of the Lord. So worship here, this line was marked by worshiping the true God. And Satan kept trying to merge these kingdoms into one, overwhelming the kingdom of Christ by the kingdoms of this world, till you get to Babel, which was an attempt of man to completely subvert the very distinct promise of the covenantal line and build a temple kingdom reaching to the heavens, wanting to reverse this arrow, to build a kingdom up instead of receive a kingdom that has come down. And now the writer of the Hebrews says, we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken. That's what's happening right now. Right now, we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. It cannot, planes cannot fly into it. It cannot be leveled. It cannot be shaken. It cannot be challenged or thwarted. The gates of hell will not prevail against it, even if half of them go to their crosses in martyrdom. The thing just keeps moving on. But the greatest danger is to try to merge these, fuse these before the consummation, before Jesus returns. And we read in the book of Revelation, the announcement, now the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdom of our God and of His Christ, and He will reign forever. What does this mean for art in particular? That's what I want to focus on in the time we have remaining here, and try to leave some time for questions and comments. And I especially would like to hear from those of you who are here who are artists, because you know, this is the sort of a Christian view of art. You can't just have preachers talking about that. You have to have artists who are well informed about their faith talking about it. They can often teach us a lot more than preachers can about a Christian view of approach to art. I mentioned last week, just briefly in passing and doing a survey of all of these different areas, that whereas in the Middle Ages, art was seen as didactic and edifying in its purpose, in the Reformation, it was set free to fulfill its own secular ends. So if you really wanted to make it in the Middle Ages, or in the Catholic Renaissance, the Catholic Counter-Reformation, as it was called, you really had to be in the employ of the church. The church would give you your living. And you would spend your life doing the Sistine Chapel or whatever, whatever else. And the goal was to make it so staggeringly, overwhelmingly impressive in its majesty and power that you had to remain a Roman Catholic. You wouldn't think about being a Protestant in one of their ugly buildings. if you could bring heaven to earth. I mean, a lot of it really was rebuilding, re-sewing the temple curtain and rebuilding the Old Covenant temple with the cherubim and the seraphim and so forth. The Protestants came along, especially the Calvinists, and said, there is a huge transition that has taken place in history. We no longer worship in a temple built by human hands. The greatest temple, the end time sanctuary, has now been built. Torn down and raised 3 days later, we are in Christ. He is our sanctuary. There are no holy places anywhere in the world anymore. Well, now wait a second. Wait, there's Rome, there's Constantinople, there's certainly Jerusalem and all the holy places there. And No, it could all be destroyed by carpet bombing. And we would say that's very tragic. We'd want to know how many people were killed. That'd be our first question. That would be a tragedy. And we wouldn't like to see buildings blown up for historical value and so forth. But it wouldn't have any religious significance at all. Human interest, like everybody else watching the news, but not, it would have no religious significance. This doesn't mean that the environments in which the Protestants worshipped were considered unimportant. The early Protestants thought more about aesthetics than we do today. They thought more about how the furniture should be arranged. They thought more about the architecture. They thought more about the specific furnishings of the church than we do today. They didn't take it less seriously, but more seriously. But their theology was in the driver's seat, and they realized that you could have different architectural expressions that in no way distorted the truth that you were presenting. Whereas the tendency, especially of the Middle Ages, the High Middle Ages, was to adopt the Gothic style for very religious reasons. There were theological arguments that stood or fell on flying buttresses and vaulting. There was a theological reason for all of this, to sort of recreate on earth, a temple, a sanctuary, reflecting the heavenly sanctuary. Whereas you walked into a Protestant church, and it could be that same cathedral, but with all images and representations, at least if it was Reformed, all images and representations of Christ and the Holy Trinity removed, The walls, often whitewashed, not in every case, but in a lot of cases, so blinding white, and your attention would be drawn to the high pulpit, either in the middle or off to the side, and to the table and the font, all three of them prominently displayed up front. And this is where the eye was drawn, to God's action, not to the theater, the drama of the Mass, but to God's action in word and sacrament. So it's theologically driven, but it could be expressed in a whole variety of styles. But it was important to think about it because we're embodied creatures. We are creatures who have more than one sense. And while Calvinists may emphasize the intellect at the expense of other senses sometimes, not so with the Reformers themselves. They were very thoughtful about the fact that we are creatures made in the image of God who have senses and are embodied in this world. And the whole notion of ugliness is next to godliness was unknown to them. It was foreign to them. But they didn't want to reconstruct the temple either. And so all of the decisions that were made that beyond the centrality of word and sacrament, all of the decisions that were made beyond the necessities of that ministry belong to creation rather than redemption. And so you just have a good architect. You'd have artists in the church. You'd have architects. You'd have people figure out the rest of it. Like their Roman Catholic counterparts, would spend what was necessary to make it attractive, to make it useful, but also to make it attractive. It wasn't just a multi-purpose facility, as often is the case today. A lot of times, it's a financial issue these days. But you also find when you talk to a lot of brothers and sisters church buildings, the assumption is often given that we shouldn't have a building at all because we are the church. If we have a building, it should just sort of be as efficient as possible without much thought to the architecture. And here again, the Reformers would say, no, creation is important. It has no redemptive significance what style we go with, but it has creational significance. In music, as I mentioned, there were different views in the Reformation on music. Some of the Reformers thought that you could have music in the church. Most of them, in fact, all of them except for Zwingli thought that. But then, as I mentioned, Zwingli started the Zurich Symphony Orchestra. So he wasn't against music. He just didn't think that music should be included in the church. Far different was the Lutheran view, which especially under the leadership of Johann Sebastian Bach, but also Telemann and others before Bach even, it should be mentioned, Bach isn't the one who started it all, you had chorales where most of the service actually was sung. If you listen to the Bach chorales, a lot of what you're hearing was actually sung by the congregation. When it says there, the choir or the chorus, "Oh, sacred head now wounded," you know, that hymn comes from one of his chorales. And so that would be sung by the congregation the way we sing it today. And then when we finished, the choir would go on with the rest of it. And it was just the whole service was choral except for the sermon. Reformed worship was always somewhere in the middle. Calvin would have the young people, the children in the church, learn the Psalms as Clement Marot and Claude Gonimel, two leading Renaissance poets and musicians, were composing the Psalter. And he would have the children learn it. And then the children's choir would teach it to the adults. The children would sing it first, in the service, and then the adults would antiphonally respond back, and that's how they would learn the Psalter. And that's how children would learn to sing. So it definitely employed some of the greatest thinkers and writers, Clément Marot, as I mentioned, Louis Bourgeois. Some of the greatest French Renaissance poets and musicians became Calvinists and wanted to write the Psalter. Same in literature. I was on a plane a while back with someone who was a few levels below the Secretary of Education for France, and he said, somehow we got around to things of faith, and I said, told him that I was Reformed, and didn't expect him to know what that was. But he said, oh, oui, Reformé. Oui. He says, John Calvin is very important in our history. We consider him the father of our language. And I had read this in books, but to hear a guy not a Christian at all mentioning this, yes, he's considered the father of modern French because of his immense, vast writing, which the average population was reading, as well as the French New Testament, the French Bible. Same with Luther and German. Modern German is, they call it Luther German. Reformation had a huge impact on art and culture. Luther's best man in his wedding was Lucas Cranach, the famous woodcut artist. And Simon, what is his last name? The curator of the Fogg Museum at Harvard. I should have brought the quote. He says, Jewish art scholar says, one of the reasons that we have the landscape, beautiful landscape painting that we have, the incredible sensitivity to nature that we have in the art of the late Renaissance era is because of Calvin. It's because, and then he quoted a section from Calvin's Institutes where Calvin said, stop painting angels already. Nothing in heaven. Don't paint anything in heaven. Everything on earth is open to you. It's like the one tree. Stop it. God knows what angels look like. You have the whole world with all of its beauty. The things that you do know, things you know that you know exactly what flowers look like. You know what cows look like. You can also depict the scenes from the Bible that don't happen to force you to break the second commandment. But when it comes to representing deity, you can't do that. Or when it comes to representing the unseen realities of heaven, you can't do that. And so they focused their energies on this world. And again, it was wonderfully liberating because people now didn't have to bring heaven down. That came in the form of the Word, where God came down and preached to us on Sunday. So we don't have to bring heaven down and make things down here a platonic reflection of the real, eternal. We can just affirm the real world as it is, created by God, fallen in sin, redeemed and awaiting its liberation at the end of the age, and take our place, take our places in that world. How then do we think about artistic criteria? This is again where you need an artist and not a preacher to tell you what the artistic criteria are for the arts. But I just want to mention things that I think are particularly closely related to biblical reasons why we should not adopt some of the criteria that we do. First of all, we have to be very careful about what our criteria are for art as Christians, because we do affirm creation and the fall and redemption altogether. And what does that mean? Well, it means that a lot of times what we read, what we see in art, what we hear, in music is going to reflect the already not yet situation of the world in which we live. You find that even in the Christian life. One day we will start hearing praise choruses maybe that sound that are modeled on Romans 7, but I haven't heard one yet. You know, the Psalter is full of that. But the constant upbeat style of a lot of contemporary worship is exhibited in the approach that a lot of Christians take to the kinds of art that they want during the week. Want it to be upbeat, saccharine, uplifting, like a Hallmark card all throughout the week. One Hallmark card after another throughout the entire week. I know I'm exaggerating for effect, but it's bad religion and bad art. There just isn't a catalog in the Bible of criteria for good art, distinguishing good art from bad art. Unlike the scientist, the artist doesn't have to account for his or her view of the universe or give a description requiring evidence and so forth, go into the lab and propound a theory that is then tested in a lab. It's a different kind of calling. And see, this is where, our Reformed forebears would say, allow each discipline to have its own criteria proper to it. Abraham Kuyper was one of the great writers in this area. He was a Reformed theologian. We remember him usually as a great Reformed theologian at the turn of the near the turn of the 19th century. But he was also the Prime Minister of the Netherlands and founded one of the major newspapers of the Netherlands. Was a poet. You know, this is one of those folks who really never came across something he couldn't do. A polymath, and he one of the things he argued, he gave the Stone Lectures at Princeton University I think it was 1901 maybe, and it's published as Lectures on Calvinism. And in those Stone Lectures, one of the things he said was one of the reasons that Calvinism is so supportive of the arts and of culture is because it does not require a particular expression. When you think Roman Catholic, you think Gothic. When you think Islamic, you think the script and the vines with the, you know, columns and every icon. Very geometric. Think southern Spain. Patterns. You don't think in terms of portraits because they didn't believe in showing portraits even of human beings. So it's very, very geometric. There are laws governing Islamic art. There are principles of Gothic architecture and so forth. There are no principles of Calvinistic art. In fact, the very idea of Calvinistic art is ludicrous. There is no Reformed architecture. And Kuyper pointed out that's one of the things that makes Reformed theology so liberating for architecture and the arts and literature and so forth. We don't need Reformed novels. We don't need a Reformed style of painting. What we need are Christians who are well-trained in their craft, their secular craft, and well-trained in their faith to be able to negotiate the relationship between the two themselves. It was marvelously liberating. It's very freeing. So there are... Every discipline has its own set of criteria appropriate to it. Now, a lot of times, you know, we have to acknowledge. At least I'm this way. I grew up in a home that was very pragmatic. My dad was a hardworking guy who thought that, you know, if you can't fix it, it probably doesn't exist. You know, everything was technical and practical, and why are you spending so much time reading that when you could be learning how to fix this over here? Come here, put that book down, come over here and I'll show you how to. Now, a lot of us were, that is a lot of the evangelical demographic. So we tend as a movement to come at art from a very practical bent. There's a great story Nathaniel Hawthorne tells of this young man who wanted to be an artist, and he worked for a very practical man. I think he was trying to make fun of the Puritans, which isn't fair. They were all dead. He was writing in the 19th century. Every novel Hawthorne wrote basically was a screed on Puritanism, but the grandchildren were getting it after their grandparents. The blacksmith was wondering, why on earth are you spending all your time dealing with, you know, in your off hours, this artistic stuff? And he kept trying to make a golden butterfly. And one day, the girl he was really in love with married the lumbering blacksmith who was to inherit his boss's estate. And as a gift, he gave her, the girl he really was in love with, this butterfly, this golden butterfly. And she wept, and of course the practical guy didn't know what it was for, thought it would be destroyed pretty soon. And sure enough, it was. The first baby they had crushed it. And the guy who made it didn't really care, because he said the point was simply to create it. And no one else in the story understood that. What's it for? What will it do? How will it work? That's a very American approach, and it's one of the reasons why you haven't ever really heard of the American Renaissance. in any field except engineering and science, and we're very practical people. We have great artists, no doubt about it. But we are basically practical people, and certainly as a movement, evangelicalism is after questions of utility. How will this be used? What's the bare minimum we can get away with aesthetically in order for this to serve our purposes? Again, I know that I'm exaggerating to make a point, but I think that that practical bent is clearly there for us. Creation is richer than utility. There are some things that are just beautiful. One of the great lines that Calvin has is when he was, you know, the monks were very much given to the idea that you only have what you need. You were issued these clothes when you came into the monastery. You don't need anything more, and you don't need good wine. You don't need all of this. And Calvin said, the Lord nowhere forbids us to buy new clothes. He forbids ostentatiousness. He forbids greed and envy and so forth. He nowhere forbids joining new possessions to old. And he says he never anywhere forbids us to drink good wine. He says, he who boggles at good wine will finally say, I only drink sweet wine, until finally he says, I can live on water. And he says, then the Christian will live that proverb where every man is afraid to step on a crack or he'll break his mother's back. And he's, you know, that was Calvin's approach. And he says, if utility is the reason, if utility is the justification for what we use and enjoy, why did God make so many shades of green? Doesn't that seem a little extravagant? That's a good point. God is an extravagant God. He's extravagant in His grace. He's extravagant in His beauty. He's extravagant in His truth. in every way, shape, or form, God is extravagant. And sometimes we imagine him as stingy, at least in those respects. It's also important for us not to, when we're thinking of criteria, to not expect art to convert or educate. That's not the purpose of art. The purpose of art is to entertain, to raise people's thoughts higher, to encourage them to maybe think of the world in a way they haven't before, to experience the world in a way they perhaps haven't before. In one of his letters, C.S. Lewis wrote, "I do most thoroughly agree with what you say about art and literature. To my mind, they can only be healthy when they are either A, admittedly aiming at nothing but innocent recreation, or B, definitely the handmaids of religious or at least moral truth." One or the other. I think the same thing could be said for music. The best music is either that which is explicitly for the church, sacred music, or that which is for the world. And at this point, I have found, and I will conclude with this point, I have found Ken Myers' categories very helpful here in trying to understand the different kinds of culture that we have. The book is titled "All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes." One of the points that Ken makes there is that there are three kinds of culture. Obviously, there are more, but three overarching categories. First of all, there is what we often call high culture. High culture is what we make, what we produce, what we generate, that kind of culture or art that we generate for its own sake. Okay, that's the Hawthorne story. Just to do it. It's like you've just made a connection with eternity. You've just sort of somehow art grabs life, takes a slice out of life and doesn't just show it to us, but envelops us in it in a way that no other form can. Not reading theology. It just does something different than reading does. So don't think of the criteria for your reading as the criteria for your enjoyment of art. They're different activities. High art is done for its own sake. It's not done to instruct, to edify, to help people. It's just done for its own sake. And then there's folk culture, Irish pubs, campfire dances in Africa, Asian ballet dancers in Bali. These are all folk cultures. Aspects of folk culture, Dixie band. This is all folk culture. The kinds of stuff that my grandma was born in 1889, and she had amazing stories. She lived till she was 100. So she lived with us, so I inherited a lot of her stories and songs that I'm now passing down to my kids who are looking bewildered as I try to teach them to them. Why do so many people die in your grandmother's songs? Was she kind of odd? My wife asked me that a lot. The children die a lot in her songs. They didn't have a lot of hospitals in Indian Territory. But that's folk culture. She She did that to create a world for me to inherit. Making cuckoo clocks in Switzerland used to be something that was done for the community. They would make, you know, so you'd have different people in town who would fulfill different functions for each other. The cobbler would get his milk from the dairyman would get his shoes from the cobbler, and that was all folk culture. Exchanges of goods that never happen, almost never happen in our economy today. Not saying, you know, okay, so let's try to be romantic and go back to exchanging shoes and milk, but it is a different world. It is a different world because folk culture, which is done for the community, for others in the community, is being eroded by pop culture, which is the third one. Pop culture could not have come about without technology. Pop culture happens when you have a car and recording tape. Of course, much more than that. But technological advances mean it's a small world after all, which is all supposed to be nice and sweet and cheery and you know, envision world peace and so forth. But it really is destructive of actual places. Think globally is, even though it says act locally, no, think locally and you'll act locally. Pop culture doesn't think locally at all. And here, for the first time, we have culture which exists to make money. Now, this is not to say that everybody who is engaging in pop culture is a materialist, nor that everybody who engaged in folk culture or high culture were altruistic only for the art, or in the folk culture, only for my friends. It is, however, to say that the economy that each generated and was part of was predominantly for these different purposes. Now the question comes, even if you are a Christian involved in pop culture, can the faith once for all delivered to the saints, which is handed down by covenant succession over time, be communicated by popular culture, which is inherently transient and based on money? These songs used to be in our hymnals with appointed to be sung in the churches by the General Assembly. Otherwise, you couldn't sing them. Appointed to be sung, and it was the tunes from Irish pubs or from, you know, Welsh minor songs or whatever. That folk music, not classical. Our hymn and psalm tunes, some of them very bad, but don't come. It's not high class. It's folk music. But the question is whether popular culture is inherently capable of carrying something important from one generation to the next. As I mentioned, the songs in our Psalter hymnal, in all the Presbyterian and Reformed churches, it would always say, appointed to be sung by the General Assembly or the General Synod. Today, you look in the praise and worship choruses, and at the bottom it says LLC or copyright. And if you go back and do your research, you find that, for instance, as a friend of mine did on Integrity Music, for example, Integrity. You know, with a name like that, something's up. They're covering for something. They're owned by Seagram's. Now, there's nothing wrong with Seagram's in its own sphere. But can you ever imagine, you know, a greater difference than appointed to be sung by this folk culture called the church for each other, for the purpose that Paul tells us singing exists in the church, so that the word of Christ may dwell in us richly, Colossians 3:16. Verses. Have you bought the copyright for that from a company owned by Seagram's. All right. Any questions or comments? Or yes. Yeah, I think partly that. I think that when a lot of times when Christians talk these days about transforming culture and being involved in culture, they really are thinking, I'm thinking here of the evangelical movement as a whole, thinking of popular culture, which is why what Disney does is more important than, boycotting Disney is more important than building something lasting and important, giving a legacy to a university or something. Because we're suspicious. Evangelicalism as a whole, I think, has been very suspicious in recent years, especially of high culture. They're the people who are taking things in a terrible direction. Forgetting, actually, that it's pop culture that is the most illicit in its defiance of any kinds of public norms. But there's this crusade against the cultural elite. What about the Christians who are going to art school to try to be among the cultural elite? What about the Christians who are already in those positions? Boy, that's another division in the body of Christ we don't need. And so what we end up doing is promoting mediocrity. We're not worried if it's mediocre. But if it's really good, we wonder what you're sacrificing. What are you meddling with there in order to get along?
Yeah. Really
right. Well, here again, if you're raised in a tradition that doesn't take the past very seriously, that really thinks you can learn best from a variety of pop cultural experiences rather than going very deeply into the past, and that affects the theology of a movement, that's also going to be reflected in its approach to culture. If you have a tradition that takes the past very seriously, but not normatively, only takes Scripture normatively, but takes the past seriously, thinks we can learn a lot from it, then you're going to have an attitude toward culture that is, I think, richer, and appreciates diversity and doesn't approach questions like the arts with sort of one-dimensional questions. Like, if I can't understand it, it must not be good art. That's something I've wrestled with as I've stood in front of a Jackson Pollock canvas. And it's just that's basically making my aesthetic experience normative, and you can't do that in the arts, again, because it's different from theology. In theology, the Bible is normative and it gives us criteria for interpreting it, but we don't find the same criteria for art, so we have to be a little bit more flexible and not expect the same kinds of rules to be imposed on art as we do other fields.
And
Sure. If your goal, if the whole purpose of pop culture is to imitate either this or this in order to extend the financial viability of the company, then that which is local is going to have to be razed to the ground because it's in the way of that kind of expansion. And today, if you ask people young kids running around in the streets of Calcutta or Costa Rica who the Madonna is, they're not going to say, even if they're in a Catholic, predominantly Catholic country, they're probably not going to think, first of all, of the Mother of our Lord. In this kind of a culture, the simulation becomes reality. The fake, the phony, becomes the real thing. And why? Because, well, it sells. Okay. But what? Quick one. Well, Ken Myers gives the example of recording tape, especially reel-to-reel. He said that's one of the things that made it easy for... You still had to get in a car and go somewhere to hear different forms of music, for example. You had to drive to Memphis to hear the blues. But now when you had recording tape, everybody's cultures began blending into one, so now you can go into a megastore and think that you have actually accessed another culture. You know, we're tourists, taking bits and pieces, surfing the cultures of the world without going deep into any one in particular.
Basically, it's kind of a byproduct of technology.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And here, people are making Stradivarius violins. They can't even tell you how they do it because it's been passed down for generations and they just do it. Here, everything is bureaucratized. Everything's written down. Nobody has to think when they make a product of this. Just crank it out. That's an exaggeration, but that's... All right. Thanks for enduring.